does a small scholarly footnote to the first reading. Most scholars believe that the book of Isaiah is written by three different people. They represent three different periods in the history of the Jews. And this one today is the beginning of what is called Deutero, or Second Isaiah. And it's very uncharacteristic prophetic language. Comfort. Give comfort to my people. But the last thing the prophets were in the business of doing was comforting people. They took very seriously the job of religious people, which is to comfort the afflicted and afflict the comfortable. The situation was this. The Jews were in exile. Literally in exile. In Babylon. The southern kingdom had been conquered by the Babylonians. The Babylonian king deported all the Jewish leaders and Second Isaiah among them. And it looked like it was all over. No promised land, no temple, nothing. And into that extraordinarily bleak and stark landscape that we have this figure saying, comfort my people. In other words, to loosely connect him with what I was proposing last Sunday, he wants them to make a new beginning. To revive their vision of the God of Israel, this great liberating God. And I think, you know, there's everything in us that has some subterranean sense that we really ought to begin all over again because things are not going so good. And I'd like to take my cue from the front page of the Boston Globe and the New York Times, et cetera, et cetera, to give some context to the possibility of a new beginning and what it may entail. We thought it was all over in Boston, eh? You know, all the 450 claims were being litigated. And then this tough Catholic lady judge named Sweeney says, no, boys, come on. I want to see all your records. So 11,000 more pages were submitted to public scrutiny. And what they reveal is things were even worse than we thought. Priests trading sex for drugs with adolescents. Another priest having fathered two children, and after having sex with this woman, she overdosed, and he stood around and then called 911, but she was dead when they came. And of course, we read all these extraordinary letters about Paul Shanley and Gagin. These flattering commentaries on the value of their ministry and how much they've done for the church and how welcome they are to these new positions and encouragement that they do okay when they get there. All this just more recently revealed. And it seems, and this is what I want to get to, it seems that Law lied. Bernard Cardinal Law, most eminent churchman in the United States, primary agent of the Pope, lied, or so it seems. And then, of course, we know, I want to get back to this lying, then we know about the bankruptcy thing, too. But the reason they don't want to go bankrupt is because then they would have to reveal all of the financial statements of the workings of the archdiocese to public scrutiny. And that's never been done. So whether they're going to declare bankruptcy or not, it's not going to depend on whether they have the money or whether they don't have the money. It's a strategic move. It's a strategic move. Now, you tell me the difference between that and the head of Enron or Global Crossing. year off.
What's the difference?
There is none, so far as I can see. Strategically, there is none. Cardinal Ratzinger again, the second highest official in the Vatican after the Pope, went on record again as saying it's the press's fault. They're out to destroy the Roman Church. Well, I have about an 8-inch stack of articles from the New York Times over the past year, and I have yet to see anything that seems vituperative, nasty, vindictive, gloating, smarmy in reporting this stuff. Somebody in the editorial staff of Boston Globe came close when he said, talking about law and possible bankruptcy, well, there is a bankruptcy in the Archdiocese of Boston already. It's moral. It's not financial. That came close to being almost over the years. Well, let's go back to Bernard Law. Did he lie? He's a busy man. He's got all kinds of stuff on his plate. Did he lie? Well, it gets a little complicated when you find that there are a great number of priests. 24 so far have been withdrawn from ministry in the Archdiocese of Boston since all this started. But there are a number of instances in which these flattering, encouraging, comforting letters were written to the priests themselves or to the people to whom they were being sent. Did Bernard Law lie? Maybe my Jesuit training, which says you have to give the author the benefit of the doubt. And I'm ready to say, well, maybe he didn't lie, really, in that lying consists of consciously speaking against what you know to be the truth. The problem may lie, not falsify, but lie, like lay lie, in his incapacity to see the truth. And this is what I want to get. If you can't see the truth, then if you say all kinds of stuff, then you're not lying, really. Why was he incapable, if that's the case, of seeing the truth? Is it because he was too busy? No, I don't think so, because there are too many instances, too many cases. And it's not just he, by the way. It's about 5 other people who are in his staff who are now bishops in dioceses all over the country, who did exactly the same kind of stuff. Is it possible that his understanding of defending the church, his understanding of where he was in the church, of what the church is such that he could not see the truth? I mean, that's a whole different problem. That's a whole different problem. A lie is a simple act in time, you know, with a beginning and an end, and you can say, okay, it started here, it ended here, now we got to pay. But this other thing is much more complicated and much more profound thing. And this is not supposed to be a great diatribe against Bernard Law, who clearly ought to resign, together with a bunch of other those guys. It is, he stands for me as an object lesson to me. About me. I mean, he sees himself in his public role. He sees himself defined by his status. He sees himself defined by his understanding of what the church is. To the effect that he cannot see the truth. I think that's what's going on. I really do. And that raises enormous range of problems. I mean, who do we think the church is? You know, and who do we think bishops are? And how do we think they ought to operate? And what's the meaning of authority in the church? Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But then, all right, that's all valuable and necessary, but there's something, especially for Advent, when we're talking about new beginnings, that's much more important. So I'd say to myself, Project, who do you think you are? How do you define yourself? White, male, clerical bureaucrat, academic, heterosexual. How do I define myself? And is there possibly, in those items of self-definition, little clouds or dust balls that occlude my vision of what is really going on? And I think the answer ought to be self-evident when I come to it from this far a starting point. Yeah. I think so. Is there blindness there? Is there blindness in everybody? It's just that in the case of law, of course, it's fraught with much graver consequences. In certain senses, financial, sociological, ecclesiastically, theologically, blah, 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 blah. Yeah, all that's true. But when you get right down to it, we are fellow travelers. And that we are both blinded by all this stuff. All these things that make us think we are who we are and what we are. And that, you know, that raises all kinds of other problems. Because how, I can't get outside myself and look at myself. I can't jump outside my skin and all my social, cultural entanglement. I say, who's Trojak Reedley? But I can make this beginning, which is biblically pervasive. I don't know who I am. That's straight out of Paul, straight out of John. I do not know who I am. And all this rum-tum and bravado and braggadocio is so much noise often enough. Either I as an individual or I as a member of an institution. So, what do we pray for? We pray to make a beginning. We pray to somehow, by the grace of God, seek to penetrate this enclosure, this cultural, linguistic, ethnic, racial, fill in all the blanks, enclosure within which I live, which is necessary for a self-definition, but does not say the last word about me, and yet I want it to say the last word about me. I want to be sure that I know who I am and what I'm doing. And we all do, I think. We all do. In other words, we are called, in this sense of making a beginning, to write much more lightly to our sense of self-definition. We're called to be much more ready to revise our judgments about ourselves. First of all, about each other, about our relationships. Please note, it should be very clear that this is not a call to say, well, you know, everything is all mushy and you can't distinguish. In the night, all cats are black. No, 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 no. That's not what I'm saying. It is a complaint against my too ready tendency to be too sure of who I am and why I do what I do. And so this can be the next step, to acknowledge, or even if I don't know, if I'm not aware, and I'm not aware of all those things that encumber me, define me, I can use, as I suggested last week, the 10 minutes every day praying. Let me know myself. Let me know you, as Augustine put it. Let me know myself. Let me know you. Because without knowing God, self-knowledge is impossible. So that's the next stage, I think. I'm trying to make a new beginning in that.